A 15-year-old boy sits in a grand jury room, surrounded by 30 strangers, tears streaming down his face as he describes years of sexual abuse. His voice cracks. He vomits from the stress. Yet he continues speaking, knowing his words could bring down one of Pennsylvania's most celebrated figures. This is Aaron Fisher's story, the teenager whose courage to break his silence exposed Jerry Sandusky and triggered one of America's most shocking institutional scandals. His journey reveals not just one predator's crimes, but an entire system designed to protect power rather than children. Jerry Sandusky didn't operate through random encounters. He constructed a systematic framework for accessing vulnerable populations through legitimate channels. Through the Second Mile charity for at-risk youth, he positioned himself among boys from unstable home environments, children seeking positive adult mentorship. 11-year-old Aaron was immediately drawn to the Penn State campus and this charismatic coach who appeared genuinely invested in his development. The manipulation unfolded with calculated precision. Group activities, swimming trips, campus tours, recreational activities gradually normalized boundary violations through seemingly inadvertent physical contact. Aaron recalls, "One day in the water, I felt uncomfortable when physical contact lasted longer than appropriate. I dismissed it as misinterpretation." This represents a key predatory tactic, causing children to doubt their own protective instincts. The progression followed a deliberate pattern: inappropriate contact during transportation, private invitations to his residence, then escalation, physical contact during post-exercise routines, invasive touching, and ultimately sexual assault. Throughout this period, Aaron experienced profound internal conflict, one awareness recognizing the inappropriateness, while another rationalized that this respected figure couldn't have harmful intentions. Sandusky's community integration amplified the danger significantly. He volunteered as Aaron's school coach, ensuring consistent access. When Aaron attempted to create distance, Sandusky intensified his pursuit, monitoring his movements, approaching him in public spaces, maintaining persistent contact. Research consistently demonstrates that abuse rarely involves strangers. It's perpetrated by trusted authority figures who methodically erode protective boundaries while cultivating extensive community credibility and institutional protection. Aaron's trauma manifested in classic symptoms. By 12, he began wetting the bed. His personality shifted from perfect child to angry and defiant, especially toward his mother, Dawn. "I'd pick fights and storm out," Aaron explains. "Deep down, I was furious she wasn't stopping what was happening, even though she didn't know." Children rarely disclose abuse directly, instead expressing distress through dramatic personality changes or behavioral regression. Aaron's grades plummeted as Sandusky repeatedly pulled him from classes, and his peers saw him as a troublemaker, deepening his isolation. When Dawn confronted Sandusky about his excessive attention, the coach transformed from intimidating to ingratiating, using what psychologist Mike Gillum called a jock giggle to downplay concerns. Dawn recalls, "Jerry was trying to act like a parent to my child, yet I felt powerless to stand up to him because of his status." At 15, Aaron asked about sex offender websites, specifically mentioning Jerry Sandusky. Even after Aaron disclosed the abuse, school officials worried about the repercussions of accusing someone so prominent. When a child's behavior changes dramatically or asks questions about inappropriate touching, these aren't coincidences. They're desperate attempts to communicate a reality too painful to name directly. Aaron's nightmares began during the abuse and intensified afterward. "I'd dream of trying to escape Jerry's basement, running up the stairs, but despite being a track star in real life, I could never outrun him in my dreams." These nightmares later evolved into scenarios where Sandusky would send people to kill his family or kidnap him. The psychological damage extended beyond sleep. Aaron developed hypervigilance, constantly checking over his shoulder, monitoring exits, checking his car's back seat. As the legal case dragged on without arrest, his mental health deteriorated. He experienced severe depression, panic attacks, and conversion disorder, a condition where psychological distress manifests as physical symptoms, landing him in the hospital with debilitating pain that had no organic cause. The body keeps the score. When emotional pain becomes unbearable, the mind transfers it to the body, creating genuine physical suffering, explaining why childhood trauma survivors frequently develop chronic health conditions. Aaron's relationship with physical touch revealed the deepest damage. After years of boundary violations, he developed profound discomfort with being touched, even therapeutic touch. Following Sandusky's conviction, Aaron and Mike Gillum shared a guy hug, the closest they'd come to an embrace. Aaron preferred couches to beds because of what happened to me in beds, a poignant reminder of how trauma transforms ordinary objects into triggers. The investigation revealed a system protecting powerful institutions over vulnerable children. When Aaron disclosed his abuse, school officials warned his family to think about the repercussions of accusing a Penn State legend rather than offering protection. Despite psychologists Mike Gillum and Children and Youth Services reporting the abuse, the response was suspiciously slow. Assigned officers changed without explanation. Sandusky wasn't questioned until January 2009, far beyond the typical 2 to 3 week timeline. Even with Aaron's testimony, corroborating hotel receipts, and formal indication for child abuse in February 2009, no arrest followed. The investigation stalled for 3 years while Sandusky remained free. Many suspected Attorney General Tom Corbett, running for governor, deliberately delayed prosecution to avoid antagonizing Penn State interests. Penn State stonewalled investigators, forcing a grand jury. The Second Mile conveniently lost the only box containing files beginning with S, Sandusky's records. Most disturbing, Penn State officials had known for years. In 2001, assistant coach Mike McQueary witnessed Sandusky assaulting a naked 10-year-old in the shower and reported it to Joe Paterno, who informed athletic director Tim Curley. No one contacted law enforcement. When finally arrested in November 2011, Sandusky was released on just $100,000 bail despite 40 counts of child sexual abuse. The magistrate setting bail was a Second Mile volunteer, a conflict requiring recusal. From administrators to law enforcement to courts, the machinery of protection surrounded Sandusky while abandoning his victims. For Aaron, coming forward was only the beginning. Over 3 years, he testified before three grand juries, reliving his trauma repeatedly. His first appearance at 15 left him crying before 30 strangers. During his second, he collapsed and vomited. By Sandusky's trial in June 2012, Aaron had endured years of anxiety and depression. Yet he faced Sandusky in court, who maintained a constant smile, turning to a smirk whenever their eyes met. It was like he was telling me he was untouchable and would get away with everything. Defense attorney Joe Amendola employed the classic tactic of asking the same questions repeatedly, relentlessly suggesting Aaron had fabricated allegations for financial gain, asking if he'd discussed getting money, if he planned to buy a new Jeep. At one point, Aaron looked directly at Gillum and mouthed, "Please make him stop." Despite this, Aaron remained steadfast. His courage, along with 8 other victims who testified, led to Sandusky's conviction on 45 of 48 counts. Aaron's journey highlights both the tremendous courage required of sexual abuse survivors seeking justice and how our system often compounds their trauma rather than facilitating healing. When the case exploded into headlines, the narrative shifted from victims to Penn State and Joe Paterno. Within a week, both university president Graham Spanier and Paterno were fired, triggering student riots supporting JOPA. The story became about a fallen football dynasty rather than harmed children. For Aaron and his family, the media frenzy created new dangers. Details about Victim 1 allowed students to identify him, leading to threats and harassment so severe he transferred schools. Don faced accusers claiming they lied for money. Mike Gillum received threats from Penn State supporters while reporters camped outside his home. Yet from this aftermath emerged something powerful. Aaron embraced his identity rather than hiding, determined to become a state trooper and help other survivors. He began working with the Let Go, Let Peace Come In Foundation, educating children, parents, teachers, and law enforcement about prevention and intervention. The mission is urgent. 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 4 boys are sexually abused before 18, over 60 million adult survivors in the U.S. alone. Though Sandusky stole years of my life, I'm moving forward, Aaron insists. I have dreams to chase, and I won't let the nightmare stop me. His journey from silence to voice has already saved countless children, transforming his personal nightmare into a legacy of protection and healing. In a world where powerful institutions still choose reputation over responsibility, Aaron Fisher's story stands as both warning and beacon, a reminder that breaking silence is the first step toward breaking cycles of abuse.